God people dwell to this very day, leading short, savage, brutal lives amongst the peaks as bandits and outlaws, preying upon any man fool enough to enter their mountains without a strong escort. Little better than the free folk beyond the wall, these mountain clans too are called wildlings by the civilized. Though the Vale is guarded by mountains, that has not prevented outside attacks. The high road from the riverlands through the mountains of the moon has seen much blood spilled. For steep and stony as it is, it provides the most likely way for an army to enter the Vale. Its eastern end is guarded by the Bloody Gate, once merely a rough-hewn, unmortared wall after the fashion of the ring forts of the First Men. But in the reign of King Osric the Fifth Aaron, this fortress was constructed anew. Over the centuries, a dozen invading armies have smashed themselves to pieces, attempting to breach the Bloody Gates.
Here are the names of the most notable clans of the Mountains of the Moon, as reported by the Archmaester Arnell in his Mountain and Vale. Stone Crows, Milk Snakes, Sons of the Mist, Moon Brothers, Black Ears, Sons of the Tree, Burned Men, Howlers, Redsmiths, Painted Dogs. Lesser clans exist as well, often being formed after some feud splinters one clan, but these usually last only a short time before they are swallowed up by rivals or wiped out by the Knights of the Vale. Most of these clan names have some meaning, however obscure those meanings might be to us. The Black Ears take the ears of men they defeat in battle as trophies, we know. Amongst the Burned Men, a youth must give some part of his body to the fire to prove his courage before he can be deemed a man. This practice might have originated in the years after the Dance of the Dragons, some maesters believe, when an offshoot clan of the Painted Dogs were said to have worshipped a fire witch in the mountains, sending their boys to bring her gifts and risk the flames of the dragon she commanded to prove their manhood.
The coast of the Vale, rocky and full of treacherous shallows and reefs, provides poor anchorage, which again has added to their defense. But the Aaron kings, well aware that their own ancestors came to Westeros from across the sea, have never neglected their coastal defenses. Strong castles and forts guard the most vulnerable coastlines, and even the stony, windswept fingers are studded with watchtowers, each with its own beacon to warn against raiders from the sea. The Andals were ever a warlike folk, for one of the seven that they worship is the warrior himself. Though secure in their own domains, some kings of the Vale have from time to time sought conquest beyond their own borders. In such wars they have the advantage of knowing that, should the fighting go against them, they could always fall back behind the great natural walls of their mountains. Nor did the kings of the Mountain and Vale neglect their fleets. In Gulltown they possessed a fine and formidable natural harbour, and under the Aarons it grew into one of the foremost cities of the Seven Kingdoms. Though the Vale itself is famously fertile, it is small compared to the domains of other kings, and even some great lords, and the Mountains of the Moon are bleak, stony, and inhospitable. Trade is therefore of paramount importance to the rulers of the Vale, and the wiser of the Aaron kings always took care to protect it by building warships of their own. In the waters off their eastern and northern coasts lie 60 islands, some no more than crab-infested rocks and roost for seabirds, others quite large and oft inhabited. With their fleets, the Aaron kings were able to extend their rule to these isles. Pebble was taken by King Hugh Aaron the Fat after a short struggle. The Paps by his grandson, King Hugo Aaron, the Hopeful, after a long one. The Witch Isle, seat of House Upcliffe, with its sinister reputation, was brought into the realm by marriage, when King Alistair Aaron, the second of his name, took Arwen Upcliffe for his bride. The last Isles to be wedded to the Vale were the Three Sisters. For thousands of years, these islands had boasted their own cruel kings, pirates and raiders, whose longships sailed the Bight, the Narrow Sea, and even the Shivering Sea with impunity, plundering and reaving as they would, and returning to the sisters laden with gold and slaves. These depredations finally led the Kings of Winter to send their own war fleets to seek dominion over the sisters, for whoever holds the Three Sisters holds the Bight. The Rape of the Three Sisters is the name by which the northern conquest of the islands is best known. The chronicles of Long Sister ascribed many horrors to that conquest, wild Northmen killing children to fill their cooking pots, soldiers drawing the entrails from living men to wind them about spits, the executions of 3,000 warriors in a single day at the Headman's Mount, Balthasar Bolton's pink pavilion made from the flayed skins of 100 sister men. How far these tales can be trusted is uncertain, but it is worth noting that these atrocities, whilst oft mentioned in accounts of the war written by men from the Vale, go largely unmentioned in northern chronicles. It cannot be denied, however, that the rule of the Northmen was onerous enough to the sister men for them to send their surviving lords scurrying to the Eyrie to plead for help from the King of Mountain and Vale. This help King Mathis Aaron, second of his name, was pleased to provide, upon the condition that the sister men agreed to do fealty to him and his descendants thereafter, and acknowledged the right of the Eyrie to rule over them. When his lady wife questioned the wisdom of involving the Vale in this war across the water, his grace famously replied that he would sooner have a pirate than a wolf for his neighbour. The king set sail for Sisterton with 100 warships. He never returned, but his sons carried on the war after him. For 1,000 years, Winterfell and the Eyrie contested for the rule of the Three Sisters. The Worthless War, some dubbed it. Time and time again, the fighting seemed at an end, only to flare up once more a generation later. The islands changed hands more than a dozen times. Thrice the Northmen landed on the Fingers. The Aaron sent a fleet of the White Knife to burn the Wolf's Den, and the Starks replied by attacking Gulltown and burning hundreds of ships in their wrath when the city walls proved too strong for them. In the end, the Aarons emerged victorious, and the Three Sisters have remained part of the Vale ever since, save for the brief reign of Queen Marla Sunderland in the immediate aftermath of Aegon's conquest. She was deposed at the sight of the approaching Bavasi fleet that the Northmen had hired at King Aegon's command. Her brother swore homage to the Targaryens, and she herself ended her days as a silent sister. This was not a case of the Eyrie winning, so much as Winterfell losing interest, Archmaester Perriston observes in A Consideration of History. For 10 long centuries, the Direwolf and the Falcon had fought and bled over three rocks, until one day the wolf awoke, as from a dream, and realized it was only stone between his teeth, whence he spat it out and walked away. House Aaron. House Aaron derives from the oldest and purest line of Andal nobility. The Aaron kings can proudly trace back their lineage to Andalus itself, and some of them have gone so far as to claim descent from Hugor of the Hill. In any discussion of the origins of House Aaron, however, it is crucial to distinguish between history and legend. There is abundant historical evidence for the existence of Sir Artis Aaron, the Falcon Knight, the first Erin king to rule over mountain and vale. His victory over King Robar II at the Battle of the Seven Stars is well attested to, even though the details of that victory might have been somewhat embroidered in the centuries that followed. King Artes was undoubtedly a real man, albeit an extraordinary one. In the Vale, however, the deeds of this real historical personage have become utterly confused with those of his legendary namesake, another Artes Erin, who lived many thousands of years earlier during the Age of Heroes, and is remembered in song and story as the Winged Knight. The first Sir Artes Erin supposedly rode upon a huge falcon, possibly a distorted memory of dragon riders seen from afar, Archmaester Periston suggests. Armies of eagles fought at his command. To win the Vale, he flew to the top of the giant's lance and slew the Griffin King. He counted giants and merlings amongst his friends, and wed a woman of the children of the forest, though she died giving birth to his son. 100 other tales are told of him, most of them just as fanciful. It is highly unlikely that such a man ever existed, like Lam the Clever in the Westerlands and Brandon the Builder in the North. The Winged Knight is made of legend, not of flesh and blood. If such a hero ever walked the mountains and vale, far back in the dim mists of the Dawn Age, his name was certainly not Artes Erin, for the Erins came from pure Andal stock, and this Winged Knight lived and flew and fought many thousands of years before the first Andals came to Westeros. Like as not, it was the singers of the Vale who conflated these two figures, attributing the deeds of the legendary Winged Knight to the historic Falcon Knight, perhaps in order to curry favor with the real Artes Erin's successors by placing this great hero of the first men amongst their forebears. The true tale of Haas Erin contains neither giants, nor griffins, nor huge falcons. Yet from the day Sir Artes first donned the falcon crown to the present, they have rightly held a storied place in the history of the Seven Kingdoms. Since the days of Aegon's conquest, the lords of the Eyrie have served the Iron Throne as wardens of the East, defending the coasts of Westeros against enemies from beyond the sea. Before that, the chronicles tell of countless battles with the savage mountain clans, the thousand-year struggle with the North over the Three Sisters, bloody sea battles wherein the Erin fleets turned back slavers from Valantis, ironborn reavers and pirates from the Stepstones and Basilisk Isles. The Starks may well be older, but their legends came before the first men had letters. Whilst the Erins fostered learning amongst the Septries and Septs, and their good works and great deeds were soon chronicled and remarked on in the devotional works of the faith. With the unification of the realm and the establishment of the boy Ronald Erin, the King Who Flew, as the first Lord of the Eyrie, there were new opportunities for the house. It was no great surprise when Queen Rhaenys Targaryen arranged the betrothal of young Ronald to the daughter of Torrhen Stark, for that was but one of the many such marriages she made in the name of peace. Sadly, Lord Ronald later died a violent death at the hands of his brother, Jonas the Kinslayer, but the Erin line continued through a kinsman, and has remained deeply involved in many of the great matters of the Seven Kingdoms. House Erin can even boast the rare distinction of twice being deemed worthy of marriage with the blood of the dragon. Roderick Erin, Lord of the Eyrie, was honoured by King Jaehaerys I, Targaryen, and his wife, the good Queen Alistan, with the hand of their daughter, Princess Daela, and a child of that union, Lady Emma Erin, in turn became the first wife of King Viserys I, Targaryen, and mother to his firstborn child, Princess Rhaenyra, who contended with her half-brother Aegon II for the Iron Throne. In that struggle, Jane Eyrin, Lady of the Eyrie and Maiden of the Vale, proved a staunch friend to Rhaenyra Targaryen and her sons, ultimately serving as one of the regents for King Aegon III. From that day, every Targaryen to sit the Iron Throne had a bit of Eyrin blood. The Eyrins played their part in the wars of the Targaryen kings and in the Blackfyre Rebellion, standing stoutly with the Iron Throne against the Blackfyre pretenders. During the first Blackfyre Rebellion, Lord Donal Eyrin boldly led the vanguard of the royalist hosts, though his lines were shattered by Daemon Blackfyre, and his lordship in peril for his life until Sir Gawain Corbray of the King's Guard appeared with reinforcements. Lord Eyrin survived to fight another day, and years later shot the Vale to traffic from the high road and by sea when the great spring sickness swept over the Seven Kingdoms. Thus the Vale and Dorne alone were unaffected by that terrible plague. In more recent years, the importance of the role played by Lord John Eyrin in Robert's Rebellion cannot be gainsaid. Indeed, it was Lord John's refusal to deliver the heads of his wards, Eddard Stark and Robert Baratheon, that began the revolt. Had he done as he was commanded, the Mad King might yet sit the Iron Throne. Despite his advanced years, Lord Eyrin fought valiantly beside Robert on the Trident. After the war, the new king proved his wisdom when he made Lord John Eyrin his first hand. His lordship's sagacity has helped King Robert rule the Seven Kingdoms wisely and justly ever since. It is a joy to the realm when a great man serves as hand to a great king, for peace and plenty will surely come of it.
At the Great Council of 101 AC, the Eyrins played little role, as Lady Jane was in her minority. To the council in her stead came the Lord Protector of the Vale, Eorbert Royce of Runestone. One of the mightiest houses of the Vale, the Royces still boast proudly of their descent from the First Men and their last great king, Robar II. Even to this day, the Lords of Runestone go into battle clad in the bronze armor of their forebears, etched with runes that are said to ward the armor's wearer from harm. Alas, the number of Royces who have died whilst wearing this runic armor is daunting. Furthermore, Maester Denniston, in his Questions, speculates that the armor is far less ancient than it appears.
The Eyrie. Many have claimed that the Eyrie of the Eyrins is the most beautiful castle in all the Seven Kingdoms, and is hard to deny the truth of this, though the Tyrells surely do. Seven slim white towers crown the Eyrie, where it sits high upon a shoulder of the giant's lance, and no castle in Westeros boasts more marble in its walls or upon its floors. And yet the Eyrins and the men of the Vale will tell you that the Eyrie is impregnable as well, for its position high atop the mountainside makes it all but impossible to assault. The smallest of the royal seats of Westeros, the Eyrie was not originally the seat of House Eyrin. That honor belongs to the Gates of the Moon, a much larger castle that stands at the foot of the Giant's Lance, on the very site where Sir Artes Eyrin and his Andals made their camp on the night before the Battle of the Seven Stars. Still uncertain on his throne in the early years of his realm, King Artes wanted a seat strong enough to withstand siege and storm, should the First Men rise against it. The Gates of the Moon served well enough in that regard, but there was more a fort than palace about it, and those seeing it for the first time have been known to remark that it is a fine castle for a lesser lord, but no fit abode for a king. This did not trouble King Artes overmuch, as it happens, for he was seldom there. The first Eyrin king spent most of his reign on horseback, riding from one end of his domains to the next in an unending royal progress. "My throne is made of saddle leather," he was wont to say, "and my castle is a tent." King Artes was succeeded by his two elder sons, who reigned in turn as the second and third kings of Mountain and Vale. Unlike their sire, they spent considerable portions of their reigns at the gates of the moon and seemed content there, though each of them commanded certain additions to the castle. It was the fourth Aeron King, the grandson of Artes I, who began the process that resulted in the building of the Eyrie. Roland Aeron had been fostered with an Andal king in the Riverlands as a boy, and had travelled widely after winning his spurs, visiting Oldtown and Lannersport before returning to the Vale upon his father's death to don the falcon crown. Having seen the wonders of the High Tower and Castley Rock and the great castles of the first men that still dotted the lands of the Trident, he felt the gates of the moon looked mean and ugly by comparison. King Roland's first impulse was to tear down the gates and build his new seat upon the same site. But that winter thousands of wildlings descended from the mountains in search of food and shelter, for the high valleys had been buried by deep falls of snow. Their depredations brought home to the king how vulnerable his seat was at its present site. Legend claims it was his future wife, Lord Hunter's daughter, Tiora, who reminded him of how his grandfather had defeated Robar Royce by attacking from the high ground. Much taken by the girl's words and by the girl herself, Lord Roland resolved to seize the highest ground of all and decreed the building of the castle that would become the Eyrie. He did not live to see it completed. The task his grace had set his builders was a daunting one, for the lower slopes of the giant's lance were steep and overgrown, and up higher the bare stone of the mountain became precipitous and icy. More than a decade was spent just clearing a winding switchback road up the mountain's side. Beyond the trees, a small army of stonemasons was set to work with hammers and chisel to carve out steps to ease the ascent where the slope grew steeper. Meanwhile, Roland sent his builders across the Seven Kingdoms in search of stone, for his grace was not pleased with the look of the marble available in the Vale. In time, there came another winter and another attack upon the Vale by the wild clans of the Mountains of the Moon. Taken unawares by a band of painted dogs, King Roland I Aeron was pulled from his horse and murdered, his skull smashed in by a stone maul as he tried to free his long sword from its scabbard. He had reigned for 26 years, just long enough to see the first stones laid for the castle he had decreed. Building continued through the reigns of his son and his son's son, but progress was painfully slow, for all the marble had to be brought in by ship from Tarth, then carried up the side of the giant's lance by mules. Dozens of the mules died whilst making the ascent, along with four common workmen and a master stonemason. Slowly the castle walls began to rise, foot by foot, until the falcon crown passed to the great-grandson of the king who had first dreamed the dream of a castle in the sky. War and wenching were the passions of King Roland II, not building. The cost of the Eyrie had become prohibitive, and the new king needed gold to pay for the campaign in the Riverlands that he was planning. Hardly had his father been laid to rest than King Roland II commanded a halt to all work on the castle. Thus it came to pass that the Eyrie was abandoned to the skies for the better part of 4 years. Falcons roosted amongst its half-completed towers, while King Roland II fought the first men in the Riverlands in search of gold and glory. Conquest proved harder to achieve than he had anticipated, however. After several small, meaningless victories over petty kings, he found himself facing Christopher IV, the Hammer of Justice. The last truly great king of the First Men handed Roland Erin a shattering defeat, then served him a worse one the following year. In peril of his life, His Grace fled to the castle of one of his erstwhile allies, an Andal lord, only to be betrayed and delivered back to Christopher in chains. 4 years after riding forth from the Vale in splendour, King Roland II was beheaded at Oldstones by the Hammer of Justice himself. Few mourned his passing in the Vale, where his belligerence and vainglory had won him no friends. When his brother Robin Aaron succeeded him, work on the Eyrie was resumed. Yet it was 43 years and 4 kings later before the castle was finally completed and fit for habitation. Maester Quince, the first man of his order to serve there, declared the Eyrie to be the most splendid work ever built by the hands of men, a palace worthy of the gods themselves. Surely even the Father above does not have such a seat. From that time to this, the Eyrie has remained the seat of House Erin in the spring, summer, and autumn. In winter, ice and snow and howling winds make the ascent impossible, and the castle itself uninhabitable. But in summer, the castle is bathed by cool, fresh mountain breezes, a welcome refuge from the sweltering heat on the valley floor below. There is no other castle like it in all the world, or at least none has been recorded that matches it.
It is worth remarking on the statue that stands in the Eyrie's Godswood, a fine likeness of the weeping Alyssa Aaron. Legend holds that 6,000 years ago, Alyssa saw her husband, brothers, and sons all slain, and that she never shed a tear. Therefore, the gods punished her by not allowing her to rest until her tears fell upon the vale below. The great waterfall that tumbles from the giant's lance is known as Alyssa's Tears, for the waters pour from such a height that they turn to mist long before they ever reach the ground. How true is the tale? Alyssa Aaron did live, of that we may be reasonably sure. But it is unlikely that she lived 6,000 years ago. True history suggests 4,000 years, whilst Denniston halves that number in questions.
The Eyrie has never fallen by force. To assault it, an attacker first must take the Gates of the Moon at the mountain's base, a formidable castle in its own right. Should that be done, the long ascent remains, and as he climbs, the attacker must assault no less than 3 way castles that protect the winding way up the mountain: stone, snow, and sky. This series of defenses makes the approach to the Eyrie difficult enough, but even should the attacker overcome each of these way castles in turn, he would then find himself at the base of a sheer cliff, with the Eyrie itself still perched 600 feet above him, reachable only by winch or ladder. Small wonder, then, that few serious efforts have ever been made to besiege the Eyrie. Since its completion, the Erin kings have always known that they had an impregnable redoubt in which to take refuge if hard-pressed. The maesters who have served Haas Erin, students of the art of warfare all, have been unanimous in the belief that the castle cannot be taken, save perhaps with dragons, as Visenya Targaryen once proved when she landed in the Eyrie's inner yard on her dragon, Vhagar, and persuaded the mother of the last Erin king to submit to House Targaryen and yield up the Falcon Crown. Almost 300 years have come and gone since that day, however, and the last dragon perished long ago in King's Landing. So the future lords of the Eyrie may once again sleep secure in the knowledge that their splendid seat remains forever invulnerable and impregnable. The Iron Islands. Were the first men truly first? Most scholars believe they were. Before their coming, it is thought Westeros belonged to the giants, the children of the forest, and the beasts of the field. But on the Iron Islands, the priests of the drowned god tell a different tale. According to their faith, the Ironborn are a race apart from the common run of mankind. We did not come to these holy islands from godless lands across the seas, the priest Soren Sortung once said. We came from beneath those seas, from the watery halls of the drowned god, who made us in his likeness and gave to us dominion over all the waters of the earth. Even among the Ironborn, there are some who doubtless and acknowledge the more widely accepted view of an ancient descent from the first men, even though the first men, unlike the later Andals, were never a seafaring people. Certainly we cannot seriously accept the assertions of the Ironborn priests, who would have us believe that the Iron Men are closer kin to fish and merlings than the other races of mankind.
Archmaester Heyrig once advanced the interesting notion that the ancestors of the Ironborn came from some unknown land west of the Sunset Sea, citing the legend of the Seastone Chair. The throne of the Greyjoys, carved into the shape of a kraken from an oily black stone, was said to have been found by the first men when they first came to Old Wick. Heyrig argued that the chair was a product of the first inhabitants of the islands, and only the later histories of maesters and septons alike began to claim that they were in fact descended of the first men. But this is the purest speculation, and in the end, Heyrig himself dismissed the idea, and so must we.
Yet however the Ironborn arose, it cannot be denied that they stand apart with customs, beliefs, and ways of governance quite unlike those common elsewhere in the Seven Kingdoms. All these differences, Archmaester Heyrig asserts in his History of the Ironborn, are rooted in religion. These cold, wet, windswept islands were never well forested, and their thin soil did not support the growth of weirwoods. No giants ever made their homes here, nor did the children of the forest walk what woods there were. The old gods worshipped by these elder races were likewise absent, and though the Andals did reach the islands eventually, their faith never took root here either. For another god had come before the seven, the drowned god, creator of the seas and father of the Ironborn. The drowned god has no temples, no holy books, no idols carved in his likeness. But he has priests aplenty. Since long before recorded history, these itinerant holy men have infested the Iron Islands, preaching his word and denouncing all other gods and those who follow them. Ill-clad, unkempt, off-barefoot, the priests of the drowned god have no permanent abode, but wander the islands as they will, seldom straying far from the sea. Most are illiterate. Theirs is an oral tradition, and younger priests learn the prayers and rituals from the elder. Wherever they might wander, lords and peasants are obliged to give them food and shelter in the name of the drowned god. Some priests eat only fish. Most do not bathe, save in the sea itself. Men from other lands often think them mad, and so they may appear, but it cannot be denied that they wield great power. Though most Ironborn have naught but scorn for the Seven of the South and the old gods of the North, they do recognize a second deity. In their theology, the drowned god is opposed by the storm god, a malignant deity who dwells in the sky and hates men and all their works. He sends cruel winds, lashing rains, and the thunder and lightning that bespeak his endless wrath. Some say that the Iron Islands are named for the ore that is found there in such abundance. But the ironborn themselves insist that the name derives from their nature, for they are a hard people, as unbending as their god. Map makers tell us that there are 31 iron islands in the main grouping of Ironman's Bay, west of the Cape of Eagles, and 13 more clustered around the lonely light, far out in the vastness of the sunset sea. The major islands of the chain number 7, Old Wick, Great Wick, Pike, Harlaw, Saltcliff, Blacktide, and Orkmund. Harlaw is the most populous of the isles, Great Wick the largest and the richest in ore, and Old Wick the holiest, the place where the kings of Salton Rock gathered in the Grey King's Hall of old to choose who would reign over them. Rugged, mountainous Orkmund was home to the Iron Kings of House Greyiron in centuries gone by. Pike boasts Lordsport, the largest town in the islands, and is the seat of House Greyjoy, rulers over the islands since Aegon's conquest. Blacktide and Saltcliff are less notable. The tower keeps of lesser lords stand on some of the smaller islets, beside minuscule fishing villages. Others are used for the grazing of sheep, while many more remain uninhabited. A secondary island grouping lies 8 days' sail to the northwest in the Sunset Sea. There, seals and sea lions make their rookeries on windswept rocks too small to support even a single household. On the largest rock stands the keep of House Farwind, named the Lonely Light for the beacon that blazes atop its roof day and night. Queer things are said of the Farwinds and the small folk they rule. Some say they lie with seals to bring forth half-human children, whilst others whisper that they are skin-changers who can take the forms of sea lions, walrus, and even spotted whales, the wolves of the western seas. Strange tales like this are common at the edges of the world, however, and the Lonely Light stands farthest west of all the lands known to us. Many a bold mariner has sailed beyond the light of its beacon over the centuries, seeking the fabled paradise said to lie over the horizon. But the sailors who return, many do not, speak only of boundless grey oceans stretching on and on forever. Such riches as the Iron Islands possess lie under the hills of Great Wick, Harlaw, and Orkmont, where lead, tin, and iron can be found in abundance. These ores are the chief export of the islands. There are many fine metal workers amongst the ironborn, as might be expected. The forges of Lordsport produce swords, axes, ringmail, and plate second to none. The soil of the Iron Islands is thin and stony, more suitable for the grazing of goats than the raising of crops. The ironborn would surely suffer famine every winter, but for the endless bounty of the sea and the fisher folk who reap it. The waters of Ironman's Bay are home to great schools of cod, black cod, monkfish, skate, ice fish, sardines, and mackerel. Crabs and lobsters are found along the shores of all the islands, and west of Great Wick, swordfish, seals, and whales roam the Sunset Sea. Archmaester Hake, born and raised on Harlaw, estimates that 7 of every 10 families on the Iron Islands are fisherfolk. However mean and poor these men might be on land, upon the sea they are their own masters. "The man who owns a boat need never be a thrall," Hake writes, "for every captain is a king upon the deck of his own ship. It is their catch that feeds the islands." Yet even more than the fishermen, ironborn esteem their reavers. Wolves of the sea, the men of the Westlands and Riverlands named them in days of yore, and rightly. Like wolves, they oft hunted in packs, crossing stormy seas in their swift longships and descending on peaceful villages and towns up and down the shores of the Sunset Sea to raid, rob, and rape. Fearless sailors and fearsome fighters, they would appear out of the morning mists to do their bloody work and be back at sea before the sun had reached its zenith. Their longships laden with plunder and crowded with wailing children and frightened women. Archmaester Harrig has argued that it was a need for wood that first set the Ironborn on this bloody path. In the dawn of days there were extensive forests on Great Wick, Harlaw, and Orkmund. But the shipwrights of the Isles had such a voracious need for timber that one by one the woods vanished. So the Ironborn had no choice but to turn to the vast forests of the Greenlands, the mainland of Westeros. All that the islands lacked, the reavers found in the Greenlands. Little and less was taken in trade. Much and more was bought in blood, with the point of a sword or the edge of an axe. And when the reavers returned to the islands with such plunder, they would say they had paid the iron price for it. Those who stayed behind paid the gold price to acquire these treasures or went without. And thusly, Harrig tells us, were the reavers and their deeds exalted above all by singers, small folk, and priests alike. Many legends have come down to us through the millennia of the Salt Kings and Reavers who made the Sunset Sea their own. Men as wild and cruel and fearless as any who have ever lived. Thus we hear of the likes of Torgon the Terrible, Jorl the Whale, Dagon Drum the Necromancer, Hrothgar of Pike and his Kraken Summoning Horn, and Ragged Ralph of Old Wick. Most infamous of all was Balin Blackskin, who fought with an axe in his left hand and a hammer in his right. No weapon made of man could harm him, it was said. Swords glanced off and left no mark, and axes shattered against his skin. Did such men ever truly walk the earth? It is hard to know, since most supposedly lived and died thousands of years before the Iron Man learned to write. Literacy remains rare in the Iron Islands to this day, and those who have the skill are oft mocked as weaklings or feared as sorcerers. So much of what we know of these demigods of the dawn comes to us from the peoples they plundered and preyed upon, written in the old tongue and the runes of the first men. The lands the reavers plundered were densely wooded, but thinly peopled in those days. Then, as now, the Ironborn were loath to go too far from the salt waters that sustained them. But they ruled the Sunset Sea from Bear Island and the frozen shore down to the Arbor. The feeble fishing boats and trading cogs of the first men, which seldom ventured out of sight of land, were no match for the swift longships of the Iron Men with their great sails and banks of oars. And when battle was joined upon the shores, mighty kings and famous warriors fell before the reavers like wheat before a scythe, in such numbers that the men of the Greenlands told each other that the Ironborn were demons risen from some watery hell, protected by fell sorceries and possessed of foul black weapons that drank the very souls of those they slew. Whenever autumn waned and winter threatened, the longships would come raiding after food. And so the Iron Islands ate, even in the depths of winter, whilst oft as not the men who had planted, tended, and harvested the crops starved. "We do not sow," became the boast of the Greyjoys, whose rulers began to style themselves Lords Reaper of Pike. The reavers brought more than gold and grain back to the Iron Islands. They brought captives as well, who would henceforth serve their captors as thralls. Amongst the Ironborn, only reaving and fishing were considered worthy work for free men. The endless stoop labor of farm and field was suitable only for thralls. The same was true for mining. Yet those thralls who were set to field work counted themselves fortunate, Harrig writes, for many and more of them lived to grow old and were even allowed to marry and have children. Such could not be said of those condemned to work the mines, those dark, dangerous pits beneath the hills where the masters were brutal, the air was dank and foul, and life was short. Most of the male captives brought back to the Iron Islands spent the remainder of their lives at hard labor in the fields or mines. Some few, the sons of lords and knights and rich merchants, were ransomed for gold. Thralls who could read, write, and do sums served their masters as stewards, tutors, and scribes. Stonemasons, cordwainers, coopers, chandlers, carpenters, and other skilled craftsmen were even more valuable.
Thraldom was a common practice amongst the first men during their long dominion over Westeros, further support for the Ironborn having descended from the first men. Further, thraldom should not be conflated with chattel slavery, as it exists in certain of the free cities and lands farther east. Unlike slaves, thralls retain certain important rights. A thrall belongs to his captor, and owes him service and obedience, but he is still a man, not property. Thralls cannot be bought or sold. They may own property, marry as they wish, have children. The children of slaves are born into bondage, but the children of thralls are born free. Any babe born on one of the islands is considered ironborn, even when both his parents are thralls. Nor may such children be taken from their parents until the age of 7, when most begin an apprenticeship or join a ship's crew.
It was young women the Reavers prized most, however. Older women were sometimes carried off by those captains in need of scullions, cooks, seamstresses, weavers, midwives, and the like, but fair maids and girls, near their first flowering, were taken on every raid. Most ended their days upon the islands as serving girls, whores, household drudges, or wives to other thralls. But the fairest and strongest and most nubile would be kept as salt wives by their captors. In their marriage customs, as in their gods, the Ironborn differ from mainland Westeros. Wherever the faith prevails in the Seven Kingdoms, a man joins himself for life to a single wife, and a maid to but one husband. On the Iron Islands, however, a man may only have one rock wife, unless she should die, whereupon he may take another, but any number of salt wives. A rock wife must be a free-born woman of the Iron Islands. Her place is at her man's side in board and bed, and her children come before all others. Salt wives are almost always women and girls captured during raids. The number of salt wives that a man can support speaks to his power, wealth, and virility. Still, it must not be thought that salt wives of the Ironborn are no more than concubines, whores, or bedslaves. Salt marriages, like rock marriages, were customarily performed by priests of the drowned god, albeit in ceremonies considerably less solemn than those that bind a man to his rock wife. And the children of such unions were considered legitimate. Salt sons may even inherit when a man has no true-born sons by his rock wife. Salt marriage has declined notably on the Iron Islands since the conquest, for Aegon the Dragon made the stealing of women a crime throughout the Seven Kingdoms, at the urging of Queen Rhaenys, it is said. The conqueror also forbade the Reavers to prey upon his own domains. These prohibitions have only been sporadically enforced under his successors, however, and many Ironborn still yearn to return to what they call the old way. Driftwood crowns, In the Age of Heroes, the legends say, the Ironborn were ruled by a mighty monarch known simply as the Grey King. The Grey King ruled the sea itself and took a mermaid to wife, so his sons and daughters might live above the waves or beneath them as they chose. His hair and beard and eyes were as grey as a winter sea, and from these he took his name. The crown he wore was made of driftwood, so all who knelt before him might know that his kingship came from the sea and the drowned god who dwells beneath it. The deeds attributed to the Grey King by the priests and singers of the Iron Islands are many and marvelous. It was the Grey King who brought fire to the earth by taunting the storm god until he lashed down with a thunderbolt, setting a tree ablaze. The Grey King also taught men to weave nets and sails, and carved the first longship from the pale hard wood of Ig, a demon tree who fed on human flesh. The Grey King's greatest feat, however, was the slaying of Naga, largest of the sea dragons, a beast so colossal that she was said to feed on leviathans and giant krakens and drown whole islands in her wrath. The Grey King built a mighty long hall about her bones, using her ribs as beams and rafters. From there he ruled the Iron Islands for 1,000 years, until his very skin had turned as grey as his hair and beard. Only then did he cast aside his driftwood crown and walk into the sea, descending to the drowned god's watery halls to take his rightful place at his right hand.
The petrified bones of some gigantic sea creature do indeed stand on Naga's Hill on Old Wick, but whether they are actually the bones of a sea dragon remains open to dispute. The ribs are huge, but nowise near large enough to have belonged to a dragon capable of feasting on leviathans and giant krakens. In truth, the very existence of sea dragons has been called into question by some. If such monsters do exist, they must surely dwell in the deepest, darkest reaches of the Sunset Sea, for none has been seen in the known world for thousands of years.
The Grey King was king over all the Iron Islands, but he left 100 sons behind him, and upon his death they began to quarrel over who would succeed him. Brother killed brother in an orgy of kinslaying, until only 16 remained. These last survivors divided up the islands between them. All the great houses of the Ironborn claimed descent from the Grey King and his sons, save, curiously, the good brothers of Old Wick and Great Wick, who supposedly derived from the Grey King's leal oldest brother. So say the legends and the priests of the Drowned God. History tells a different tale. The oldest surviving records at the Citadel reveal that each of the Iron Islands was once a separate kingdom, ruled by not one, but 2 kings, a Ruck King and a Salt King. The former ruled the island itself, dispensing justice, making laws, and settling disputes. The latter commanded at sea, whenever and wherever the island's longship sailed. Surviving records suggest that the Ruck Kings were almost always older than the Salt Kings. In some cases, the two were father and son, which has led some to argue that the Salt Kings were no more than heirs, crown princes to their fathers. Yet there are other instances known to us where the Ruck King and Salt King were of different houses, sometimes even rival houses known to be inimical to one another. Elsewhere in Westeros, petty kings claim crowns of gold by virtue of their birth and blood, but the driftwood crowns of the Ironborn were not so easily won. Here alone in all of Westeros, men made their own kings, assembling in great councils called King's Moots to choose the Ruck Kings and Salt Kings who would rule over them. Whenever a king died, the priests of the Dran god would call a king's moot to choose his successor. Every man who owned and captained a boat was allowed a voice at these unruly gatherings, which often went on for days, and in a few instances far longer. The Ironborn also tell of occasions when the priests called the captains and the kings together to remove an unworthy ruler. The power wielded by these prophets of the Dran god over the Ironborn should not be underestimated. Only they could summon king's moots, and woe to the man, be he lord or king, who dared defy them. The greatest of the priests was the towering prophet Galen Whitestaff, so called for the tall, carved staff he carried everywhere to smite the ungodly. In some tales his staff was made of weirwood, in others from one of Nargah's bones. It was Galen who decreed that Ironborn must not make war on other Ironborn, who forbade them to carry off each other's women or raid each other's shores, and who forged the Iron Islands into a single kingdom, summoning the captains and the kings to Old Wick to choose a high king to reign supreme over Salt Kings and Rock Kings alike. They chose Orres Greyiron, called Ironfoot, the Salt King of Orkmond, and most fearsome reaver of that age. Galen himself placed a driftwood crown upon the High King's head, and Orres Ironfoot became the first man since the Grey King to rule over all the Ironborn. Many years later, when Orres Ironfoot died of wounds sustained whilst reaving, his elder son seized his crown and proclaimed himself King Eric the First. Though half-blind and feeble with age by that time, Galen nonetheless arose in fury at these tidings, declaring that only the king's moot could make a king. The captains and the kings assembled once more on Old Wick, and Eric the Ugly was unmade and condemned to death, a fate he avoided by breaking up his father's crown and casting it into the sea as a sign of his submission to the drowned god. In his place the king's moot raised up Regnar Drum, called Ravenfeeder, the Rock King of Old Wick. The centuries that followed were a golden age for the Iron Islands, and a dark age for such first men as lived beside the sea. Once the reavers had gone forth seeking food to sustain them during hard winters, wood to build their longships, salt wives to give them sons, and the riches the Iron Islands lacked. But they had always returned home with their plunder. Under the Driftwood Kings, the practice gave way to something far more difficult and dangerous. Conquest, colonization, and rule.
By tradition, the Driftwood Crown itself was broken up and returned to the sea upon the death of its wearer. His successor would don a new crown made from driftwood freshly washed up upon the shore of his home island. Thus, every driftwood crown was different from those that had gone before. Some were small and simple, others huge, unwieldy, and magnificent.
Archmaester Herrig's exhaustive History of the Ironborn lists 111 men who wore a driftwood crown as High King of the Iron Islands. The list is admittedly incomplete and rife with contradictions, yet none can doubt that the Driftwood Kings reached the zenith of their power under Corrid the First Hoar, given as Grey Iron in some accounts and as Black Tide in others, who wrote his name in blood in the histories of Westeros as Corrid the Cruel. King Corrid ruled over the Ironborn for 75 years of a century, living to the ripe old age of 90. By his day, the first men of the Green Lands had largely abandoned the shores of the Sunset Sea for fear of the reavers, and those who remained, chiefly lords in stout castles, paid tribute to the Ironborn. It was Corrid who famously boasted that his writ ran wherever men could smell salt water or hear the crash of waves. In his youth he captured and sacked Oldham.